Session number 13265, wheel number 14.
Mr. Marsden, reel 14. I think you wanted to correct something there.
Yes. Yes, belay that last remark. The engines are not throttled back. Just as the aircraft is going to touch down, an extra burst of power is given to pull it forward, and then the throttles are chopped back, and the kite would sit on the deck and roll forward. I'm quite sure they could have got it down onto a football pitch. Both 83 Squadron and 49 Squadron pilots had that weighed off. But that required the use of full flap and a power-on controlled descent, and this was stopped by the RAF about this time, because on some aircraft, pilots were doing this and they were getting a tip stall and piling in, and there'd been a number of crashes. So the method of approach using flap now became to be a long, steady, slow approach at a controlled rate of descent. The kind of approach which is done today, 3-degree angle and all that business. Right. During this time too, we'd begun to get problems with the tail wheel. Whilst we'd been operating from grass, just for ordinary training flying, conversion flying and so on, there had been no problems. But as modifications were introduced and additions to the aircraft during the first part of 1941, the all-up weight of the kite went up. Those self-sealing fuel tanks, for instance, increased the weight. All sorts of other modifications. The single K-guns on either side on the beam had been replaced by a twin gun mounting, so there were now two K-guns either side, and I think we'd had an extra fuel tank installed, or rather the new aircraft coming in had an extra fuel tank installed to increase the range, and all these increases in weight had pushed the all-up weight of the kite up by several thousand pounds. And that meant that the undercarriages, of course, were getting more hammer, and especially in circuits and bumps, where you're doing continuous takeoffs and landings all day whilst the pilot is learning to handle the aeroplane. And not always gentle landings anyway. So we had quite a number of tailwheel failures. Now, when you get a tailwheel failure on concrete, it gets quite exciting, because the magnesium alloy, as you drag it along a concrete surface, begins to behave just like a match striking on a matchbox, and you get a big trail of sparks and a shower of flame off the back, like the underside of the Grand Prix cars when they bottom. Now, on a Grand Prix car on the ground, that's quite interesting and pretty to watch, but it's not frightening. But when aeroplanes start burning, people begin to get worried, especially if they're in them. And so we didn't fly on the concrete very much, except for operations. When aircraft began to use the concrete regularly, at the increased all-up weight, we discovered that the tail wheel now was no longer the happy-go-lucky little device it had been before, behaving quite well. The moment you touched down and got the tail end solidly down, it began to chatter. In other words, it oscillated violently on its spindle, on its pivot. And of course, in so doing, it scrubbed rubber, and if there were any damage, any defects or wear in it and so on, you were apt to get the tail wheel burst, which left you where you were before, creating a shower of sparks, this time with torn rubber dragging as well. And not very nice, and it also meant an awful lot of work, because we had to get the usual thing is to get the flight out there, all the available men out there under the back, and you lift the aeroplane up on your backs and stand there with your hands on your knees holding it whilst a couple of riggers change the tail wheel, which gets a bit wearing. And so there was a whole lot of modifications introduced to try to cure this tailwheel shudder. The main one was to produce a kind of cam ring which was bolted onto the tailwheel oleo leg with a detent in the ring and a spring-loaded plunger with a roller on it into the detent, and this allowed the tailwheel to be steerable when the aircraft was taxiing. But the idea was that it would stabilise or reduce the judder on landing, tend to centralise it. Well, they seemed to work once or twice new, and after that they didn't do much good either. All you got was a harder judder. Might a little bit slower, but with a lot more bang in it because of the effect of the spring-loaded plunger in the middle. And so it was decided that the thing to do now would be to fix the tailwheel. The tailwheels up to this time had been retractable. The aircraft was designed with a retractable tailwheel. And so now the tailwheel was locked in the down position. And that meant a loss of performance on the aircraft of very nearly 5 miles an hour at cruising and upper speeds. And as a result of it, you'll find most of the literature will tell you that the Halifax came out with a fixed tailwheel, and it was only later that the tailwheel was modified to be retractable. Whereas, of course, all Halifaxes were made with retractable tailwheels, but locked in the down position against the time when they should find a cure for the problem. The cure was found later on, and it was found out on the Mosquito, which suffered the same problem. On the Mosquito, the cure was discovered to be to produce a tailwheel which was grooved with a single deep groove, so that what you had in effect was a tailwheel made up of two narrower wheels. Although it was in one piece, it was made as a single wheel, it was like two wheels side by side. And they discovered that the two separate surfaces effectively stopped the scrub and the judder. And so a Halifax wheel was produced of like nature, with a deep groove in the tread of the tyre, although those these were smooth tyres. I'm speaking of the tread as the wearing face. And that cured it. And so they could go back to having retractable tailwheels again and get that little bit of performance back again. Another problem which occurred in these early months was that in battle damage, if you got a bullet in the wrong place, you could find your undercarriage coming down and dangling. And we lost at least one aircraft from that reason. The drag of the dangling undercarriage caused fuel consumption to run up, and they ended up dumping in the North Sea Channel or somewhere and having to take a swim. And so it was decided to install a safety device, which was in effect rather like a long door bolt. About a half inch steel rod which went into a couple of lugs which were fitted, bolted onto the main leg from the rear, so that when the leg was in the up position, horizontal, the two lugs with about an inch and a quarter hole in them lined up with this rod, which reached back into the rest section between the two spars of the wing in the centre fuselage. And the handle for this bolt arrangement came under the seat on either side. There was one of these bolts on either side, in either side wing route. The flight engineer had the job once on operations. The flight engineer had the job once they were off and clear of going back to there, reaching under the, getting on his hands and knees, reaching under the seat and pushing the bolt into position so that it was engaged with the undercarriage. And after that, you, your hydraulics could go all to pot and it would simply drop a fraction of an inch and be hanging on the bolt. Bolt was made, a long bolt with a couple of extension lugs on it, so that you simply, it only had to travel a few inches to engage and be free. They weren't trying to push it the whole width of the undercart leg. And to get the undercarriage down in those circumstances, you had to pull the bolt back, and the undercarriage would come down as a result of having bungee cords installed on the leg, on the undercarriage leg, so that when the undercarriage was retracted, those bungees were put into tension, and when you released it, the tension in the bungees would gradually, quite slowly, push the main leg down. So that, we got that cleared up, or somebody did, you know, the, somebody had the job of sorting that problem out and coming up with this, these ideas. The undercarriage doors were not operated by any controlled part of the hydraulic system. They were, each undercarriage, set of undercarriage doors had a, was operated by a separate closed system, so that when the undercarriage came down, it pushed the doors open. And there was a roller fitted on either side of the main leg against which the split edge of the undercarriage door would move, and the roller would move under it so that it wasn't scraping. See, that the edge ran across a roller. On the door came down, the leg came down, pushed the doors open, and the doors then rested in the open position, but under load, because in going down they loaded a hydraulic jack which loaded a small accumulator, so that when the undercarriage retracted, the load placed in this little hydraulic system was sufficient to haul the doors shut again. Straightforward?
Yes.
Yeah. That meant, of course, that when the when the aircraft stood with the doors open, this jack system on each door was under load. And unfortunately, the skinning to which it was attached was not heavy enough for the job in the original design, and there began to be the odd failure there as the jack began to tear away from the inner skin of the undercarriage door. And that didn't appear until, oh, I suppose, nearly 12 months later than the time of which I've just been speaking. That began to appear in 1942. And it produced one or two interesting results. Always seems to happen to me, this kind of thing does. Anyway, one of the first funnies or unasties, whatever you like, connected with the safety bolt in the undercarriage occurred when Willie Tate had taken, he'd gone in an aircraft away to Leeming for some official reason or other, and Chiefy Murray, the flight sergeant, had gone with him. Now Chiefy really didn't like flying. I'm not sure that he liked aeroplanes even, but he was in the Air Force and he was a fitter one. And belay that, I'm mixing two events. Chiefy Murray was with Willie Tate when the second event occurred a year later in connection with these undercarriage doors. So Lee has come back again to the aircraft where Willie has been taken off, and wherever he's been on this particular occasion, he's coming back with this aircraft and on finals and coming in to the airfield. One leg down. the starboard leg down, and the port leg still up. And I thought, so I ran out in front of the control tower, and I shouted up to the pilot, the duty pilot in the control tower, "That's Wing Commander Tate, and he's going to crash. Give him a red." "I can't do that," I said. "Give him a red. Go away, Corporal, and stop shouting, or I'll put you on a charge. Wing Commander Tate knows what he's doing." I said, "Wing Commander Tate doesn't know what he's doing." I said, "One of the up bolts, one of the up locks has slipped into place, and he doesn't know it. And he doesn't know that he could get his undercarriage down," I said, "and he's making a landing on one leg, and he's going to right that aircraft off. If you don't shut up, Corporal, I shall put you on a charge. Go away." So I ran out on the field, and I waved my arms in the switch off cross, you know, finish sign, trying to warn them. But of course, the pilot and second Dickey, they're both looking. By the way, I got it wrong. It wasn't the starboard leg that was down, it's the port leg that was down. The starboard one up. Both the pilots are watching their landing, you see. So the aircraft comes in, lands on the port leg, rather heavily, wipes off the wheel from its mountings, because the undercarriage is... I told you it's a very strong undercarriage. It simply wiped the wheel off, and the wheel, with some of its oleo legs and bits, comes out from underneath and starts bouncing in the air about 100 feet in the air. The aircraft then fully settles onto its belly and proceeds to separate itself into in its production components. The outer wings come away, the nose breaks away at the fuselage joint in front of the wing, the rear fuselage breaks away at the joint at the rear of the centre section, and the whole thing finally comes to rest in a cloud of dust, and out of it run three or four buds who gallop out of the holes. They don't bother getting out of access hatches or anything, they just come out of the holes that have been provided where the fuselage snaps across. But as they run out, there's this awful boom, boom going on, and they suddenly realise they've got about half a ton of wheel and undercarriage bouncing up and down, and so they have to run, dodging about in between the bounces of this dirty great chunk of debris. And it was surprising how long that stayed stable enough to continue bouncing, more or less vertically. And they got out clear. Well, I heard no more about being put on a charge, but some little time later, outside the pilot's crew room, appeared a large board about 6 foot by 4 foot with a whole lot of full plate photographs on it, showing this aircraft from various angles in its component parts where it came to rest, and a large notice in the middle saying, "Do you check your wheels before landing? This pilot didn't." You see? Now that's Willie Tate's idea, and he was the pilot, which gives you an idea of the measure of the man. And what had happened was that he'd be coming in on finals, and he'd looked at the dash, selected undercart down, looked at the dash, and seen two greens. Fair enough, Two main wheels. Only one of the greens was the tail wheel, which was locked down. The uplock bolt had in fact vibrated into place just enough to hold the other undercart, the starboard undercart up, which was exactly what I had worked out, and which of course was exactly what that stupid duty pilot didn't know, because he didn't know the aeroplane. If he'd given him a red, as I'd shouted on finals, that would have been one Halifax saved. As it was, they were something, I don't know how many thousand pounds, how many man-hours work down the drain. And of course, all our work, we had to go out there and shift the pieces, all for nothing, and send it off to a maintenance unit. Well, I was a bit niggled about that myself. The other story, which I was going to mention with regard to the undercarriage doors, as I say, that was on 1652 conversion unit, about 12 months later. The because of the damage to the undercarriage doors, until we had a modification scheme to correct that problem, we took the doors off and we flew with no undercarriage doors on at all, which meant that when the undercarriage was up, the undercarriage was unfaired. And remember, this is a conversion unit converting Whitley Wellington pilots to Halifaxes. An awful lot of circuits and bump flying. And so we were getting in a lot of hours. Willie Tate was CO at one time, and he laid the law down, no 48-hour passes until the unit is doing 1,000 hours a month. And in Yorkshire, in winter, that wants a bit of doing at times. So we had to flog at that. Anyway, the result was, though we didn't know it at the time, that the unfaired undercarriages were producing tail buffet. It wasn't noticeable when you were flying, and I was doing quite a bit of flying as flight engineer. Still, I was coming up some 300 hours plus by this time just on this kind of flying. And Willie had been off in my kite, and with Chiefy with him, they'd been over to Leeming and were coming back. When the aircraft came in sight, it was flying, for want of a better word, a sinusoidal path in the vertical plane, following a kind of rounded wave action, very gently, but
no sine curve.
A sine curve. The nose was coming up and levelling, and then the nose would go down and it would follow these very gentle fugoids. And he did that all around the circuit, and I said, well, that's not Johnny Johnson flying that. I said, that's my kite, that's Willie Tate. The reason for mentioning Johnny Johnson, not the fighter pilot Johnny Johnson, this one, he was four group bomber pilot. He used to like flying Halifaxes or whatever. And when he got going, when he got in the air, he'd start singing to himself, da 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 dee, da 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 da, and so on, you see, pushing the joystick backwards and forwards quite gently, so you floated through the air over the waves. And the occasional visiting passenger and whatnot might get a bit airsick. But it was, he used to thoroughly enjoy himself there like that, and everybody knew it. But I knew it wasn't Johnny flying it, you see, so we couldn't understand. Well, Willie landed and taxied in and got out, and his face was like a turkey cock. You know, he's fairly good colour at the best of times. Do you know Willie Tate at all?
No.
Oh, well, Willie, I won't say he was eccentric, but he wore red silk socks, his tunic was lined with red silk, his greatcoat was lined with red silk, and he always dressed rather smartly. And he had fairly good coloured cheeks. I don't know whether that was whiskey or what, but I might be doing him an injustice. Probably is now, from what I hear. Anyway, he was not a happy man. And he stormed off and shouted for me, which was unusual because he wasn't a shouting man. He was a winko at this time. And he went round to look at the tailplane. Well, we went round to look at the tailplane, and round the tailplane roots on the underside, on a Halifax, there is quite a reasonable size fairing with a radius between the horizontal surface of the tailplane and the vertical of the fuselage the radius would be one of 3.5-4 inches, and the fairing is held there by shallow mushroom-headed screws with the heads about 1/2 inch across. At a guess, they were probably 2BA screws. And where those screws went through the fairing into the fuselage, there were a whole series of slot holes and bright patches where the fairing had been rubbing underneath the screw heads. Now, you didn't need to be Sherlock Holmes to realise on the strength of that the tailplane had been rocking up and down, which was the cause of Willie's angst, because every time he put down elevator on, the elevator then acted as a servo and pushed the tailplane up. The Halifax tailplane was held by two horizontal bolts at the front acting as pivots, so that the rear or main spar of the tailplane itself could be pulled down onto a seat, and if necessary it could be shimmed vertically for adjustment, and there were vertical bolts holding it at the rear. And as a result of tailplane buffet and consequent tailplane vibration, the locking wires on those vertical bolts had sheared, and the bolts themselves had begun to undo. The locking nuts had begun to shift, allowing, in this particular case, something like 1/2 inch of travel. Maybe a little bit more. As far as I could see, it was the fairings which had been limiting the travel on the tailplane, rather than the knots themselves, which were by now shifted quite away. And the locking must have failed sometime just after takeoff, and the buffet in consequence had shifted the knots during the flight out and the flight back and whatever else Willie had been doing during the afternoon, because the aircraft had been perfectly fit up to that time. And whilst it's the rigger's job to inspect the airframes inspecting the anchorage on a tailplane is not a thing which you would commonly expect to have to do. You know, it's a thing you might look at 60-hour inspections or something of that order, but not certainly for daily inspections. Not the main bolt fittings. You would look at the controls and hinges and things like that, where you would expect fractures might occur through load and movement, but not the main fixing. And here it is, the main fixing that's gone. And it's my aeroplane, and I'm the corporal in charge. And Willie wasn't happy with me at all. As I say, he'd been having to fly with more or less reverse controls. When he gave down elevator, he got up tailplane. And the tailplane area is greater than the elevator area, so the tailplane area is the one that works. So he's having to fly it as though he's operating the tailplane as a flying tailplane with the elevators as servos. So he's flying in the reverse sense, which is just a touch tricky, I suppose, you know, when you have to pick it up in the air offhand. So as a result of all that, all the Halifaxes are grounded in order that the